my own fault," continued Arthur. "I did hear you order me to get down, but I got scared to death, and when it started to burn, I totally lost my head. I'm very afraid of pain, Mr. Shewhart."
"Get up," said Redrick without turning around. "That was a piece of cake. Get up. Stop lolling around."
Hissing from the pain in his scalded shoulders, he heaved the backpack onto his back and put his arms through the straps. It felt like the skin in the scalded areas had shriveled and was now covered in painful wrinkles.
"He's afraid of pain. Screw you and your pain." He looked around. All right, they hadn't strayed from the trail. Now for those hills with the corpses. Those lousy hills. Standing there, the jerks sticking out like a damn pair of buttocks, and that valley between them. He involuntarily sniffed the air. Ah, that rotten valley. It really is a piece of shit. Damn thing.
"See that valley between the hills?" he asked Arthur.
"Yeah."
"Aim straight at it. Forward."
Arthur wiped his nose with the back of his hand and moved forward, splashing through the puddles. He was limping and no longer looked as straight and athletic as before. He'd gotten bent and was now walking carefully and very cautiously.
"Here's another one I've dragged out," thought Redrick. "How many does that make? 5, 6? And the question is, what for? What is he, my flesh and blood? Did I take responsibility for him? Listen, Red, why did you drag him out? Almost kicked the bucket myself because of him. Right now, with a clear head, I know I was right to drag him out. I can't manage without him. He's like a hostage for my monkey. I didn't drag out a man. I dragged out my mind detector. My trawler. A key. But back there in the hot seat, I wasn't even thinking about that. I dragged him like he was family. I didn't even consider abandoning him, even though I'd forgotten about everything. About the key and about the monkey. So, what do we conclude? We conclude that I'm actually a good man. That's what Gouda keeps telling me and what the late Kirill insisted on, and Richard always drones on about it. Yeah, sure, a good man. Stop that, he told himself. Virtue is no good in this place. First you think, and only then do you move your arms and legs. Let that be the first and last time, got it? A do-gooder. I need to save him for the grinder, he thought coldly and clearly. You can get through everything here but the grinder. Stop, he told Arthur. The valley was in front of them, and Arthur had already stopped, looking at Redrick in bewilderment. The floor of the valley was covered in a puke-green liquid, glistening greasily in the sun. A light steam was wafting off its surface, becoming thicker between the hills, and they already couldn't see a thing 30 feet in front of them, and it reeked. God only knew what was rotting in that medley, but to Redrick it seemed that 100,000 smashed rotten eggs poured over 100,000 spoiled fish heads and dead cats couldn't have reeked the way it reeked here.
"There will be a bit of smell, Red, so don't, you know, wimp out."
Arthur let out a guttural sound and backed up. Redrick shook off his torpor, hurriedly pulled a package of cotton balls soaked in cologne out of his pocket, plugged his nostrils, and offered them to Arthur.
"Thank you, Mr. Shewhart," said Arthur in a weak voice. "Can't we go over the top somehow?"
Redrick silently grabbed him by the hair and turned his head toward the pile of rags on the rocks.
"That used to be Four Eyes," he said, "and over there on the left hill, you can't see him from here, lies the poodle, in the same condition. Got it? Go ahead."
The liquid was warm and sticky, like pus. At first they walked upright, wading up to their waists.
The ground beneath their feet, fortunately, was rocky and relatively even, but Redrick soon heard the familiar buzzing on both sides. There was nothing visible on the sunlight-drenched left hill, but the shady slope to the right became full of dancing lilac lights.
"Bend down," he ordered through his teeth and bent down himself. "More, dumbass," he yelled. Arthur bent down, scared, and that very instant thunder split the air. Right over their heads, a forked lightning bolt shimmied in a frenzied dance, barely visible against the backdrop of the sky. Arthur squatted and went in up to his neck. Redrick, sensing that the thunder had blocked his ears, turned his head and saw a quick, fading, bright crimson spot in the shade near the rock scree, which was immediately struck by a second lightning bolt.
"Keep going, keep going," he bellowed, not hearing himself. Now they walked, squatting, one behind the other, only their heads sticking out of the muck. And with each lightning bolt, Redrick saw Arthur's long hair stand on end and felt a thousand needles pierce the skin of his face. "Keep going," he repeated in a monotone. "Keep going." He no longer heard a thing once Arthur turned his profile toward him, and he saw the wide-open, terrified eye looking sideways at him and the quivering white lips and the sweaty cheeks smeared with green gunk. Then the lightning got so low they had to dunk their heads in the muck. The green slime plastered their mouths, and it became hard to breathe. Gasping for air, Redrick pulled the cotton out of his nose and discovered that the stench had disappeared, that the air was filled with the fresh, sharp smell of ozone, while the steam around them kept getting thicker and thicker. Or maybe things were going dark before his eyes. He could no longer see the hills either to the left or to the right. He couldn't see a thing except for Arthur's head covered in green muck and the yellow steam swirling around them. "I'll make it through, I'll make it through," thought Redrick. "Not my first time. It's my life story. I'm deep in shit, and there's lightning above my head. That's how it's always been. And where did all this shit come from? So much shit. It's mind-boggling how much shit there is in one place. There's shit here from all over the world. It's a vulture's doing," he thought savagely. "The vulture came through here. He left this behind him. Four Eyes kicked the bucket on the right. The poodle kicked the bucket on the left. And also the vulture could go between them and leave all this shit behind him. Serves you right," he told himself. "Anyone who walks in the vulture's footsteps always ends up eating shit. Haven't you learned that already? There are too many of them, vultures. That's why there are no clean places left. The whole world is filthy." "Noonan's an idiot." "Redrick," he said, "you're a destroyer of balance. You're a disturber of peace. For you, Redrick," he says, "any order is bad. A bad order is bad. A good order is bad. Because of people like you, there will never be heaven on earth." "How the hell would you know, fat ass? When have I ever seen a good order? When have you ever seen me under a good order? My whole life, all I've seen is guys like Kirill and Four Eyes go to their graves so that the vultures could crawl worm-like between their corpses, over their corpses, and shit, shit, shit." He slipped on a rock that came loose under his foot, got completely submerged, came to the surface, saw Arthur's twisted features and bulging eyes right beside him, and for a moment went cold. He thought that he had lost his bearings, but he hadn't lost his bearings. He immediately figured out that they had to head to where the tip of the black rock was sticking out of the muck. He realized that even though the rock was the only thing he could see in the yellow fog. "Stop," he hollered. "Head farther right. Go to the right of the rock." He couldn't hear his own voice again, so he caught up with Arthur, grabbed him by the shoulder, and demonstrated with his hand, "Head to the right of the rock. Keep your head down." "You'll pay me for this," he thought when he was next to the rock. Arthur dived under, and the lightning immediately struck the black tip with a crack, shattering red-hot bits. "You'll pay me for this," he repeated, ducking his head under the surface and working as hard as he could with his arms and legs. Another peal of thunder rang hollowly in his ears. "You'll be sorry you were born." He had a fleeting thought. "Who am I talking to? I don't know, but somebody must pay. Somebody has got to pay me for this. You just wait. Let me only make it to the sphere. Let me get to the sphere. I'll shove this shit down your throat. I'm not the vulture. I'll make you answer in my own way." When they managed to get to dry ground, to the rock scree already heated white hot by the sun, they were deafened, turned inside out, and clutching each other so as not to fall over. Redrick saw the truck with the peeling paint sunk on its axles and dimly recalled that here, next to this truck that could catch their breath in the shade. They climbed into its shadow. Arthur lay down on his back and unzipped his jacket with lifeless fingers while Redrick leaned against the side of the truck, wiped his hand as best he could on the broken rock, and reached inside his jacket.
"I want some, too," said Arthur. "I want some, too, Mr. Shuhart."
Redrick, amazed at how loud this kid's voice was, took a sip and closed his eyes, listening to the hot, all-cleansing stream as it poured down his throat and spread through his chest. Then he took another sip and passed the flask to Arthur. "That's all," he thought listlessly. "We made it. We've made it through this, too, and now for what's owed me. You thought that I'd forget. No, I remember everything. You thought I'd be grateful that you left me alive, that you didn't drown me in this shit. Screw you. You'd get no thanks from me. Now you're finished, you get it? I'm going to get rid of all this. Now I get to decide. I, Red Shuhart, of sober judgment and sound mind, will be making decisions about everything for everyone. And all the rest of you, vultures, toads, aliens, bonies, quarterblads, parasites, raspies, in ties and uniforms, neat and spiffy with your briefcases, with your speeches, with your charity, with your employment opportunities, with your perpetual batteries, with your bug traps, with your bright promises. I'm done being led by the nose. My whole life I've been dragged by the nose. I kept bragging like an idiot that I do as I like, and you bastards would just nod, and then you'd wink at each other and lead me by the nose, dragging me, hauling me through shit, through jails, through bars. Enough." He unfastened the backpack straps and took the flask from Arthur's hands. "I never thought," Arthur was saying with a meek bewilderment in his voice. "I could have never imagined. Of course, I knew death, fire. But this, how in the world are we going to go back?" Frederick wasn't listening to him. What this manling said no longer mattered. It didn't matter before, either, but at least before he'd still been a man. And now he was nothing. A talking key. Let it talk. "It'd be good to wash up," Arthur was anxiously looking around. "If only to rinse my face." Redrick glanced at him absent-mindedly, saw the matted, tangled hair, the fingerprint-covered face smeared with dried slime, and all of him coated with a crust of crackling dirt, and felt neither pity nor annoyance. Nothing. A talking key. He looked away. A bleak expanse, like an abandoned construction site, yawned in front of them, strewn with sharp gravel, powdered with white dust, flooded with blinding sunlight, unbearably white, hot, angry, and dead. The far side of the quarry was already visible from here. It was also dazzlingly white, and at this distance appeared to be completely smooth and sheer. The near side was marked by a scattering of large boulders, and the descent into the quarry was right where the red patch of the excavator cabin stood out between the boulders. That was the only landmark. They had to head straight toward it, relying on good old-fashioned luck. Arthur suddenly sat up, stuck his hand underneath the truck, and pulled out a rusty tin can. "Look, Mr. Shuhart," he said, becoming more animated. "Father must have left this. There's more in there, too." Redrick didn't answer. "You shouldn't have said that," he thought indifferently. "You'd be better off not mentioning your father. You'd be better off just keeping your mouth shut. Although it actually doesn't matter." He got up and hissed from the pain because all his clothing had stuck to his body, to his scalded skin, and
Now something in there was agonizingly peeling, tearing off like a dried bandage from a wound. Arthur also got up and also hissed and groaned and gave Redrick an anguished look. It was obvious that he really wanted to complain, but didn't dare. He simply said in a stifled voice, "Could I maybe have just one more sip, Mr. Shuhart?" Redrick put away the flask that he'd been holding in his hand and said, "See the red stuff between the rocks?" "Yeah," said Arthur, taking a shuddering breath. "Head straight toward it. Go." Arthur stretched, groaned, squared his shoulders, grimaced, and, looking around, said, "If I could just wash up a little. Everything is stuck." Redrick waited in silence. Arthur looked at him hopelessly, nodded, and started walking, but immediately stopped. "The backpack," he said. "You forgot the backpack, Mr. Shuhart." "Forward," ordered Redrick. He wanted neither to explain nor to lie. And in any case, he didn't have to. The kid would go as is. He had no choice. He'd go. And Arthur went. He plodded, hunching, dragging his feet, trying to tear off the junk that was stuck firmly to his face, having turned small, pitiful, and skinny like a wet stray kitten. Redrick followed behind, and as soon as he went out of the shade, the sun burned and blinded him, and he shielded his face with his hand, regretting that he didn't bring sunglasses. Each step raised a small cloud of white dust. The dust settled on their boots, and it stank. Or rather, it was Arthur that reeked. Walking behind him was unbearable, and it was a while before Redrick realized that the stench mostly came from himself. The odor was nasty, but somehow familiar. This was how it stank in town on the days the north wind would carry the factory smoke through the streets. And his father stank the same way when he came home from work, huge, gloomy, with wild red eyes, and Redrick would scurry into some distant corner and from there would watch timidly as his father would tear off his work coat and hurl it into his mother's arms, pull his giant worn boots from his giant feet and shove them under the coat rack, and lumber to the bathroom in his socks, his feet sticking to the floor. Then he'd spend a long time in the shower, hooting and noisily slapping his wet body, clanging basins, muttering things under his breath, and finally roaring all over the house, "Maria, you asleep?" He had to wait while he washed up and sat down at the table, which already contained half a pint of vodka, a deep dish with a thick soup and a jar of ketchup, wait until he drained the vodka, finished the soup, burped, and got started on the meat with beans, and then you could come out of hiding. Climb on to his knees and ask which foreman and which engineer he drowned in sulfuric acid today. Everything around him was unbearably hot, and he felt nauseated from the dry, cruel heat, from the stench, from exhaustion, and his scalded skin, which blistered at the joints, smarted violently, and it seemed to him that through the hot haze that was shrouding his consciousness, his skin was trying to scream at him, begging for peace, for water, for cold. Memories, so worn out they didn't seem to be his, crowded his bloated brain, knocking one another over, jostling one another, mingling with one another, intertwining with the sultry white world, dancing in front of his half-open eyes. And they were all bitter, and they all reeked, and they all excited a grating pity or hatred. He attempted to break into this chaos, tried to summon from his past some kind of sweet mirage, feelings of happiness or affection. Out of the depths of his memory, he squeezed the fresh laughing face of Gouda. Then still a girl, longed for and untouched. It would appear for a moment, but would then immediately get flooded with rust, distort and turn into the sullen, furry face of the monkey, overgrown with coarse brown hair. He tried to remember Kirill, a holy man, his fast, certain movements, his laugh, his voice promising fantastic and wonderful places and times,
and Kirill would appear in front of him, but then the silver cobweb would sparkle brilliantly in the sun, and there'd be no Kirill, and instead Raspy Hugh would be staring Redrick in the face with angelic unblinking eyes, and his large white hand would be weighing the porcelain container. Some dark forces burrowing in his consciousness immediately broke through the barrier of will and extinguished the little good that was still preserved in his memory, and already it seemed that there had never been anything good at all. Only smirking mugs, mugs, mugs. And this whole time he'd remained a stalker, without thinking, without realizing it, without even remembering. He would feel it in his bones. On their left, at a safe distance, a happy ghost hovered over a pile of old wooden boards. Peaceful, used up, so to hell with it. From the right, meanwhile, a light breeze was beginning to blow, and in a few steps he sensed a bug trap, flat as a mirror and many-pointed like a starfish. A long way away, no need to fear. And at the center of the trap was a bird, flattened into a shadow, a rare thing. Birds almost never flew over the zone. And over there, next to the trail, were two abandoned empties. Looked like the vulture had thrown them away on the way back, fear being stronger than greed. He saw it all, took it all into account, and as soon as the disfigured Arthur strayed even a foot from the trail, Redrick's mouth would open by itself, and a hoarse warning shout would fly out of its own accord. A machine, he thought. It made a machine out of me. Meanwhile, the broken boulders on the edge of the quarry kept getting closer, and he could already make out the intricate rust patterns on the red roof of the excavator cabin. "You're a fool, Burbridge," thought Redrick. "Cunning, but a fool. How did you ever believe me, huh? You've known me since I was little. You should know me better than I know myself. You've gotten old, that's what. Gotten dumber. And it has to be said, you spent your whole life dealing with fools." And then he imagined the look on Burbridge's face when he found out that his Arthur, Archie, the pretty boy, his flesh and blood, that the kid who followed Red into the zone in his, the vulture's, footsteps wasn't some useless twerp, but his own son, his life, his pride. And imagining this mug, Redrick roared with laughter, and when Arthur glanced back at him, frightened, he continued to roar and gestured at him, "Onward, onward!" And once again a procession of smirking mugs, 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 crawled across his consciousness as if across a screen. It all had to change. Not one life, not two lives, not one fate, not two fates. Every little bit of this stinking world had to change. Arthur stopped in front of the steep descent into the quarry, stopped and froze in place, staring down into the distance, craning his long neck. Redrick came up to him and stopped nearby, but he didn't look where Arthur was looking. Right under their feet was a road stretching into the depths of the quarry, formed many years ago by caterpillar tracks and the wheels of heavy trucks. The right slope was white and cracked by the heat, while the left slope had been partially excavated, and there, between the boulders and heaps of rubble, stood the excavator, tilted to one side, its lowered bucket jammed impotently into the side of the road. And, as was to be expected, there was nothing else to see on the road except the twisted black stalactites resembling thick spiral candles dangling from the rough ledges right by the bucket, and the large number of black splotches visible in the dust, as if someone had spilled asphalt. That was all that was left of them. You couldn't even tell how many there'd been. Maybe each splotch had been one person, one of the vulture's wishes. This one, that's the vulture coming back safe and sound from the basement of the 7th complex, That bigger one over there, that's the vulture bringing the moving magnet out of the zone, unscathed. And that one? That's the luscious Dina Burbridge, the universally desired slut, who didn't look like either her mom or dad. And that spot? That's Arthur Burbridge, the pretty boy, who also didn't look like either his mom or dad. The apple of the vulture's eye. We made it, Arthur croaked ecstatically. Mr. Shuhart, we made it after all, huh? He laughed, a happy laugh, crouched down and beat the ground with his fists as hard as he could. The tangle of hair on the crown of his head trembled and swayed in an odd and funny way. Clumps of dry dirt flew in every direction, and only then did Redrick raise his eyes and look at the sphere. Carefully, apprehensively, with a suppressed fear that it would be all wrong, that it disappoint, raise doubts, throw him out of the heaven he'd managed to ascend to, choking on shit along the way. It wasn't golden, it was closer to copper, reddish, completely smooth, and it gleamed dully in the sun. It lay under the far wall of the quarry, cozily nestled between the piles of accumulated ore, and even from this distance you could see how massive it was and how heavily it pressed on the ground beneath it. There was nothing about it to disappoint or raise doubts, but there was also nothing in it to inspire hope. Somehow it immediately gave the impression that it was hollow and must be very hot to the touch. The sun had heated it up. It clearly wasn't radiating light, and it clearly wasn't capable of floating in the air and dancing around the way it often happened in the legends about it. It lay where it had fallen. It might have tumbled out of some huge pocket or gotten lost, rolling away during a game between some giants. It hadn't been placed there. It was lying around, just like all the empties, bracelets, batteries, and other junk left over from the visit. But at the same time, there was something about it, and the longer Redrick looked at it, the clearer it became that looking at it was enjoyable, that he liked to approach it, that he liked to touch it or even stroke it. And for some reason, it suddenly occurred to him that it'd probably be nice to sit next to it, and even better, to lean against it, to throw his head back, close his eyes and think things over, reminisce, or maybe simply doze, resting. Arthur jumped up, quickly undid all the zippers on his jacket, tore it off, and threw it at his feet with all his might, raising a cloud of white dust. He was yelling something, making faces and waving his arms, then he put his hands behind his back and skipped down the slope, dancing and performing intricate steps with his feet. He no longer looked at Redrick. He forgot about Redrick. He forgot about everything. He went to make his wishes come true. The little secret wishes of a college boy who had never in his life seen any money except for his so-called allowance, a kid who had been mercilessly beaten whenever he came home smelling even slightly of alcohol, who was being brought up to be a famous lawyer and in the future a senator, and in the most distant future, naturally, the president. Redrick, screwing up his inflamed eyes against the blinding light, kept watching him in silence. He was cold and calm. He knew what was about to happen, and he knew he wasn't going to look. But for now, it was still all right to watch, and so he looked on, feeling nothing in particular, save that perhaps somewhere deep inside him, a little worm had started to wriggle, uneasily spinning its prickly little head. And the boy kept going down the steep slope, skipping along, tap-dancing to some extraordinary beat, and white dust flew from under his heels, and he yelled something at the top of his voice, very clearly and very joyously and very solemnly, like a song or an incantation. And Redrick thought that this was the first time in history of this quarry that someone was going down this road in such a way as if going to a party. And at first he didn't hear what this talking key was shouting, but then something seemed to switch on inside him, and he heard. Happiness for everyone. Free. As much happiness as you want. Everyone gather round. Plenty for everyone. No one will be forgotten. Free. Happiness. Free. With that, he abruptly went quiet, as if a huge hand had forcefully shoved a gag into his mouth, and Redrick saw the transparent emptiness lurking in the shadow of the excavator bucket grab him, jerk him up into the air, and slowly, with an effort, twist him the way a housewife wrings out laundry. Redrick had the time to notice one of the dusty shoes fly off a twitching foot and soar high above the quarry. He turned around and sat down. There wasn't a single thought in his head, and he somehow stopped being able to sense himself. Silence hung in the air, and it was especially silent behind his back on the road. Then he remembered the flask. Without his usual joy, merely like a medicine it was time to take. He unscrewed the cap and drank in small, stingy sips. And for the first time in his life, he wished that the flask didn't contain alcohol, but simply cold water. A certain amount of time passed, and relatively coherent thoughts started forming in his head. Well, that's done, he thought, unwillingly. The road is open. He could even go right now, but it'd be better, of course, to wait a little longer. Grinders can be tricky. In any case, I need to think. I'm not used to thinking. That's the thing. What does it mean, to think? To think means to outwit, dupe, pull a con, but none of these are any use here. All right. The monkey. Father. Let them pay for everything. May those bastards suffer. Let them eat shit like I did. No, that's all wrong, Red. That is, it's right, of course, but what does it actually mean? What do I need? These are curses, not thoughts. He was chilled by some terrible premonition and, instantly skipping the many different arguments still lying ahead, ordered himself ferociously, "Look here, you red-headed asshole. You aren't going to leave this place until you figure it out. You'll keel over next to this ball, you'll burn, you'll rot, bastard, but you aren't going anywhere. My lord, where are my words? Where are my thoughts?" He hit himself hard in the face with a half-open fist. "My whole life I haven't had a single thought. Wait, Kirill used to say something like..." Kirill feverishly dug through his memories and... Some words did float to the surface, more or less familiar, but none of them were right, because words were not what Kirill had left behind him. He left some vague pictures, very kind, but utterly improbable. "Treachery, treachery. Here, too, they've cheated me. Left me voiceless, the bastards. Riffraff. I was born as riffraff. I've grown old as riffraff. That's what shouldn't be allowed. You hear me? Let that be forbidden in the future, once and for all. Man is born in order to think. There he is, Kirill, finally. Except that I don't believe that. I've never believed it, and I still don't believe it. And what man is born for? I have no idea. He's born, that's all. Scrapes by as best he can. Let us all be healthy, and let them all go to hell. Who's us? Who's them? I don't understand a thing. If I'm happy, Burbridge is unhappy. If Burbridge is happy, Four Eyes is unhappy. If Raspy is happy, everyone else is unhappy, and Raspy himself is unhappy, except he, the idiot, imagines that he'll be able to wriggle out of it somehow. My lord, it's a mess, a mess. My entire life I've been at war with Captain Quarterblad, and his whole life he's been at war with Raspy, and all he's ever wanted from me, the blockhead, was one thing. That I stop being a stalker. But how do I stop being a stalker when I have a family to feed, get a job, and I don't want to work for you? Your work makes me want to puke, you understand? If a man has a job, then he's always working for someone else. He's a slave, nothing more. And I've always wanted to be my own boss, my own man, so that I don't have to give a damn about anyone else, about their gloom and their boredom. He finished the rest of the cognac and hurled the empty flask at the ground with all his strength. The flask jumped up, gleamed in the sun, and rolled away somewhere. He immediately forgot about it. He was now sitting down, covering his eyes with his hands, no longer trying to think or understand, but to at least envision something, how things ought to be. But again, he only saw mugs, mugs, mugs. Money, bottles, piles of rags that used to be people, columns of numbers. He knew that it all had to be destroyed, and he longed to destroy it, but he could guess that if they were all gone, then there'd be nothing left, only flat, bare earth. The helplessness and despair again made him want to lean against the sphere and throw his head back. So he got up, mechanically dusted off his pants, and began descending into the quarry. The sun was baking. Red spots were swimming in front of his eyes. The hot air rippled at the bottom of the quarry, and because of this, the sphere seemed to dance in place, like a buoy in the waves. He walked past the excavator bucket, superstitiously raising his feet high and taking care not to step on the black splotches. And then, sinking into the crumbly rubble, he dragged himself across the quarry to the dancing and winking sphere. He was covered in sweat and suffocating from the heat, but at the same time he was chilled to the bone, trembling hard all over, as if hungover, and the flavorless chalk dust was crunching between his teeth, and he was no longer trying to think. He just kept repeating to himself in despair like a prayer. I'm an animal. You can see that I'm an animal. I have no words. They haven't taught me the words. I don't know how to think. Those bastards didn't let me learn how to think. But if you really are all-powerful, all-knowing, all-understanding, figure it out. Look into my soul. I know everything you need is there. It has to be. Because I've never sold my soul to anyone. It's mine. It's human. Figure out yourself what I want. Because I know it can't be bad. To hell with it all. I just can't think of a thing other than those words of his. Happiness free for everyone. And let no one be forgotten.
And Now and Afterward by Boris Strugatsky, 2012. The story of writing this novel, in contrast to the story of publishing it, doesn't include anything amusing or even instructive. The novel was conceived in February 1970 when my brother and I got together in Komarovo, a Russian town on the Gulf of Finland, to write The Doomed City. At odd moments during evening strolls through the deserted, snow-covered streets of that tourist town, we thought of a number of new plots, including those of the future Space Mowgli and the future Roadside Picnic. We kept a journal of our discussions, and the very first entry looks like this. A monkey and a tin can. 30 years after the alien visit, the remains of the junk they left behind are at the center of quests and adventures, investigations and misfortunes. The growth of superstition. A department attempting to assume power through owning the junk. An organization seeking to destroy it. Knowledge fallen from the sky is useless and pernicious. Any discovery could only lead to evil applications. Prospectors revered as wizards. A decline in the stature of science. Abandoned ecosystems. An almost dead battery. Reanimated corpses from a wide variety of time periods. In these same notes, the confirmed and final title, Roadside Picnic, makes an appearance, but the concept of a stalker is nowhere to be seen. There are only prospectors. Almost a year later, in January 1971, again in Komarovo, we developed a very thorough and painstakingly detailed plan of the novel, but even in this plan, literally on the eve of the day we finally stopped coming up with the plot and started writing it, our drafts didn't include the word stalker. Future stalkers were still called trappers. Trapper Redrick Schuhart. The trapper's girlfriend, Guta. The trapper's little brother, Sedwick. Apparently, the term stalker came to us in the process of working on the first pages of the book. As for the prospectors and trappers, we didn't like those terms to begin with. I remember this well. We were the ones who introduced the English word stalker into the Russian language. Stalker, pronounced stalker in Russian, is one of the few words we coined that came into common use. Stalker spread far and wide, although I'd guess that this was mainly because of the 1979 film of that name, directed by Andrei Tarkovsky and based on our book. But even Tarkovsky latched onto it for a reason. Our word must really have turned out precise, resonant, and full of meaning. It would have been more correct to say stalker instead of stalker. But the thing is, we didn't take it from a dictionary at all. We took it from one of Rudyard Kipling's novels, the old pre-revolutionary translation of which was called The Reckless Bunch, or something like that, about rambunctious English school kids from the end of the 19th to the beginning of the 20th century and their ringleader, a crafty and mischievous kid named Stalky. In his tender years, Arkady, while still a student at the Military Institute for Foreign Languages, received from me a copy of Kipling's Stalky and Company that I happened to pick up at a flea market. He read it, was delighted, and right then made a rough translation called Stalky and Company, which became one of the favorite books of my school and college years. So when we were thinking of the word stalker, we undoubtedly had in mind the streetwise Stalky, a tough and even ruthless youth, who, however, was by no means without a certain boyish chivalry and generosity. And at the time it didn't even cross our minds that his name wasn't Stalky at all, but was actually pronounced Stalky. Roadside Picnic was written without any delays or crises in just three stages. On January 19, 1971, we started the rough draft, and on November 3rd of the same year, we finished a good copy. In the interim, we kept busy with a wide variety of typically idiotic pursuits, wrote complaints to the ruling Senate, i.e., the Secretariat of the Moscow Writers Organization, answered letters, which, sitting side by side, we did fairly rarely, composed a government application for a full-length popular science film called The Meeting of Worlds, about contact with another intelligence, wrote three shorts for the popular Soviet television series Fitil, or something like it, thought of a plot for the TV movie They Chose Rybkin, worked out a first draft of the plot of the new novel Strange Doings at the Octopus Reef, and so on and so forth. There were no follow-ups or ultimate outcomes for any of these scribbles, and they have absolutely no relation to subsequent events. Remarkably, The Picnic had a relatively easy passage through the Leningrad Aurora, a Soviet literary journal, not encountering substantial difficulties and sustaining damage only during the editing, and minor damage at that. Of course, the manuscript had to be purged of various shits and bastards, but these were all familiar trivialities, beloved by writers the world over. The authors didn't retreat from a single principal position, and the magazine version appeared at the end of the summer of 1972, practically unscathed. The saga of The Picnic at the publisher Young Guard, YG, was only beginning then. Actually, strictly speaking, it began in early 1971, when The Picnic didn't yet exist on paper and the novel was only being offered in the broadest of terms in an application for an anthology. This putative anthology was called Unintended Meetings, was dedicated to the problem of humanity's contact with another intelligence, and consisted of three novels, two finished, Dead Mountaineer's Hotel and Space Mowgli, and one that was still being written. Difficulties began immediately. 3-16-71, A.S. The higher-ups read the anthology but are hemming and hawing and saying nothing definite. By their request, the anthology was given to a certain doctor of historical sciences, question mark, to review, on the grounds that he really likes science fiction. Then the manuscript, along with this review, will come back to Avramenko, the assistant head editor, probably to give her a chance to reevaluating the existing but secret assessment, and after that will make its way to Osipov, the head editor, and only then will we be apprised of our fate. Bastards. Critics. 4-16-71. A.S. I saw Bella at the YG. She said there's nothing doing. Avramenko asked her to try to be diplomatic about it, to tell us that there's no paper and they are all booked up and so on and so forth, but she told me straight out that somewhere in the upper echelons, they suggested having nothing to do with the Strugatskys for the time being. That's the hegemony bearing down. And the picnic wasn't written yet. And we're talking essentially about novels that have never caused a big ideological disturbance, about little stories that are completely harmless and even apolitical. It's just that the higher-ups wanted nothing to do with those Strugatskys at all. And this overall reluctance was being superimposed on a difficult situation within the publishing house. This was right at the time that the change of leadership was taking place, when they were beginning to root out all the best things created by the then editorial SF staff under Sergei Georgievich Zhemaitis and Bella Grigorievna Klyueva, due to whose cares and labors flourished the second generation of Soviet science fiction. At the start of the 1980s, Arkady and I were giving serious thought to the project of gathering, organizing, and disseminating, at least by samizdat, A History of One Publication, or How It's Done, a compendium of genuine documents, letters, reviews, complaints, applications, authorial wails and howls in written form, related to the history of publishing the anthology Unintended Meetings, whose key novel turned out to be The Picnic. At one time, I had even begun systematically sorting and selecting the existing materials, but soon gave it up. It was dead-end work, a laborious task with no future, and there was a certain palpable immodesty in the whole project. Who were we, after all, to use our own example to illustrate the functioning of the ideological machine of the 1970s, especially against the background of the fates of Alexander Solzhenitsyn, Georgi Vladimov, Vladimir Voinovich, and many, many other worthies? The project was abandoned, but we returned to it once more after the beginning of perestroika in the mid-1980s, during the dawn of the new and even newest times, when there appeared a real possibility of not merely passing around a certain collection of materials, but of publishing it according to all the rules, with didactic commentary and venomous descriptions of the main characters, many of whom had retained their positions at the time and were capable of influencing literary processes. We were joined by indefatigable Ludens, a Strugatsky term indicating a subspecies of humans with superior mental powers, Vadim Kazakov, a science fiction expert and literary critic from Saratov, and his friends. I relayed all the materials to them. The compendium was for the most part ready, but pretty soon it became clear that there was no real possibility of publishing it. No one had the money for this kind of publication, which was unlikely to be profitable. Besides, things were happening at breakneck speed. The putsch, Arkady's passing, the fall of the USSR, the Democratic Revolution, a velvet revolution, but a revolution nonetheless. For a period of literally months, our project lost the most minimal relevance. And now I'm sitting behind a desk, staring at three reasonably thick folders lying in front of me, and am aware of a disappointment mixed with uncertainty and a noticeable touch of bewilderment. Inside these folders are the letters to the Young Guard Publishing House, to the editors, the managing editor, the head editor, the director, complaints to the Central Committee of the All-Union Leninist Young Communist League, CCAULYCL, plaintive petitions to the Department of Culture of the Central Committee of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, CCCPSU, and, of course, replies from all these organizations and our letters to each other. A veritable mountain of paper, by the most conservative calculation, more than 200 documents, and I have no idea now what to do with it all. At first I was looking forward to using this afterward to tell the story of publishing The Picnic, naming once-hated names, jeering to my heart's content at the cowards, idiots, informers, and scoundrels, astounding the reader with the absurdity, idiocy, and meanness of the world we're all from, being ironic and instructive, deliberately objective and ruthless, benevolent and caustic, all at once. And now I'm sitting here, looking at these folders and realizing that I'm hopelessly late and that no one needs me. Not my irony, not my generosity, and not my burnt-out hatred. They have ceased to exist, those once powerful organizations with almost unlimited right to allow and to hinder. They have ceased to exist and are forgotten to such an extent that it would be tedious and dull to explain to the present-day reader who is who, why it didn't make sense to complain to the Department of Culture of the CC, why the only thing to do was to complain to the Department of Print and Propaganda, and who were Albert Andreevich Belyaev, Pyotr Nilevich Demichev, and Mikhail Vasilyevich Zimyanin. And these were the tigers and elephants of the Soviet ideological fauna, rulers of destinies, deciders of fates. Who remembers them today? And who cares about those of them who are still among the living? So then why bother with the small fry, the shrill crowd of petty bureaucrats of ideology, the countless ideological demons who caused untold and immeasurable harm and whose vileness and meanness require, as they like to write in the 19th century, a mightier, sharper, and more experienced pen than my own. I don't even want to mention them here. Let them be swallowed up by the past, like evil spirits, and disappear. If I did, after all, decide to publish here even a simple list of pertinent documents with a brief description of each one, this list would look approximately like this. 430-75, A to B. The editors have serious doubts about RP. 5675. A letter from A and BS to Medvedev with a request for an editorial response. 62575. A letter from Zhibarov explaining the delay. 7875. The editorial response from Medvedev and Zhibarov. 72175. A reply from A and BS to the editorial response. 82375. B to A. The anthology was touched up and sent to the editors back in July. 9175. A notification from Zhibarov acknowledging receipt of the manuscript. 11575. A letter from Medvedev rejecting the picnic. 11-17-75. A letter from A and BS to Medvedev arguing against the rejection. 11-17-75. A letter from Medvedev to B expressing perplexity. 1-8-76. A letter from A and BS to Polshuk with a complaint about Medvedev. 1-24-76. A notification from Parshin acknowledging the receipt of the letter to the CCAUL-YCL. 2-20-76. A letter from Parshin about measures taken. 3-10-76. B to A. Proposing letters to Parshin and Sinelnikov. 3-24-76. A letter from A and BS to Parshin with a reminder. 3-24-76. A letter from A and BS to Sinelnikov with a reminder. 3-30-76. A letter from Parshin about measures taken. 4-5-76. A to B. Suggesting a letter to higher authorities. 4-12-76. A letter from Medvedev rejecting the picnic. And so on, so forth. Who needs this today, and who today would read it? But if not this, then what is there left to write about? Without this tedious, boring list and the gloomy, spiteful commentary on it, how do you tell the story of publishing The Picnic? A story that is, in a certain sense, almost mysterious. Because this novel probably wasn't without its flaws, but at the same time, it was also not without evident merits. It was clearly gripping, capable of making a reasonably strong impression on a reader. It did, after all, inspire a remarkable reader like Andrei Tarkovsky to make an outstanding film. At the same time, it certainly didn't contain any criticism of the existing order, and on the contrary, seemed to be in line with the reigning anti-bourgeois ideology. So then why, for what mysterious, mystical, infernal reasons, was it doomed to spend more than 8 years passing through the publishing house? At first, the publisher didn't want to enter into a contract about the anthology at all. Then it did, but for some reason revolted against the novel Dead Mountaineer's Hotel. Then it seemed to agree to replace Dead Mountaineer's Hotel with the previously approved novel Hard to Be a God, but then it categorically revolted against The Picnic. It's impossible here to even give a brief account of this battle. It turns out to be too long. It was 8 years, after all. There were unexpected repudiations of the publisher's own demands. Suddenly, for no reason at all, down with Hard to Be a God. And 5 or 6 renewals of the contract. And even sudden attempts to break off the relationship entirely, all the way up to court. But mainly, and the whole time, and obstinately and invariably, from 1 year to the next, from 1 conversation to the next, from 1 letter to the next, take the reanimated corpses out of the picnic. Change Redrick Shuhart's language. Insert the word Soviet when talking about Kirill Panov. Get rid of the bleakness, hopelessness, coarseness, savageness. I've preserved a remarkable document, the page-by-page comments on the novel Roadside Picnic by the language editors. The comments span 18 pages and are divided into sections. Comments concerning the immoral behavior of the heroes, comments concerning physical violence, and comments about vulgarisms and slang expressions. I can't allow myself not to produce a couple of excerpts. And keep in mind, I am in no way selecting quotes, not looking for idiocies on purpose. I'm presenting the comments in order, beginning with a paragraph from the explanatory letter that accompanied the pages. Of course, we, the editors, only copied out those expressions and words that, in our opinion, require either removal or substitution. These comments are first and foremost dictated by the fact that your book is intended for teenagers and young people, for members of the Young Communist League who see Soviet literature as a textbook on morals, a guidebook to life. Comments concerning the immoral behavior of the heroes. There are 93 comments in all. The first 10 are presented. Must stick your fat ass, page 21. I'll walk on my teeth, never mind my hands, page 21. Crawling on all fours, page 32. Take out the flask, unscrew it, and attach myself to it like a leech, page 35. Suck the flask dry, page 35. I need just one more sip, page 35. I'll get plastered tonight. I gotta beat Richard, that's the thing. The bastard sure knows how to play. Page 38. And I need a drink. I just can't wait. Page 42. I would have been happy to drink with you to that. Page 42. Without saying a word, pours me a shot of vodka. I clamber up onto the stool, take a sip, grimace, shake my head, and take another sip. Page 43. Comments concerning physical violence. There are 36 comments in all. The last 9 are presented. Grabbed a heavy beer stein from the bar and smashed it with all his might into the nearest roaring mug. Page 179. Redrick felt in his pocket, picked out a nut that weighed about an ounce, and taking aim, flung it at Arthur. It hit him right in the back of the head. The boy gasped, etc. Page 182. Next time I'll knock a couple of teeth out. Page 182. Kicked Redrick in the face with his free leg and wriggled and flopped around, etc. Page 185. Convulsively kneading the head of this damned kid with his chest, couldn't take it anymore and screamed as hard as he could. Page 185. Now that cute little face appeared to be a black and gray mask made of ashes and coagulated blood, etc. Page 185. Redrick threw him face down into the largest puddle. Page 186. May those bastards suffer. Let them eat shit like I did. Page 202. He hit himself hard in the face with a half-open fist. Page 202. Comments about vulgarisms and slang expressions. There are 251 comments in all. An arbitrary 10 from the middle are presented. He suddenly began to curse, impotently and spitefully, using vile, dirty words, showering Redrick with spittle. Page 72. Put in your teeth and let's go. Page 72. The butcher cursed. Page 74. You're scum. A vulture. Page 74. Asshole. Page 76. I'm dying of hunger. page 77. The monkey was dozing peacefully, page 77. He was dirty as hell, page 78. To hell with this, page 82. Beeped